This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. It is Friday, December 26th, 2003, 10:04 a.m. on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This morning we're talking about technology and child rearing. During the second half of the show, I welcome you to join our conversation. The numbers are 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go to geekspeak.org, click on The Geeks, and then send a message. I'll be giving out those numbers and information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks John Tracy, owner and operator of FeltonGames.com, and Miles Elam, programmer and student of American literature. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you. Good
morning, Lyle.
Before we start our discussion today on childhood and technology, let's do a spot of news. John.
I'd like to do a little follow-up with the NPR coverage on the Beagle 2 Mars probe. For those of you who didn't hear, ESA, the European Space Agency, sent a probe piggybacked on a satellite called Mars Express, and it was a small probe called Beagle 2. Beagle 2 is going to Mars to look for life on the nano level. It's looking for very small signs of life, much like the Viking lander did back in the 70s.
But theoretically better.
Theoretically way better, yes. I think they use something akin to pouring rocks into chicken soup and heating it.
Yeah, Viking, that's what they do for Viking. They look for the gases output.
And exactly. Yeah,
they did find interesting stuff, activity. But the scientists decided that it's possible that could have happened just from chemical reaction.
Exactly. So, yeah, Viking was inconclusive. So this had a lot more experiments on it and had a lot better experiments.
This has a lot more, a lot better still, right?
Has.
More
better.
More better.
We haven't heard from it. What happens is the Beagle detached from it from Mars Express, and it was going to land kind of Mars rover style, where it has these airbags that deploy, and then it lands, hits pretty hard, the airbags pop off, and then it was like a clamshell, two halves, like a CD case almost, and it opens up, and then these solar panels pop out. And then it was supposed to gather sunlight until nighttime, and then shut down for night. And it was supposed to recharge itself enough to have enough heat to survive the Martian night. One of the fears is that these solar panels didn't deploy properly, or it didn't open, or it crashed on impact, and wasn't able to gather enough energy to survive the Martian night. One of the things they were looking for today was a signal. It was supposed to send out a signal. Let me see if I've got that here.
A series of beeps and boops, right?
Right, yeah. It was like
a modem call kind of a sound.
Here, let me see.
I don't know if you could even hear that.
It sounded very technical, though. I like the whole breaking the mic apart. That's good. So that's the kind of stuff? It's sending out music.
It would basically send out this little call sign that says, I'm awake, I'm here, I'm ready for instructions. And we would get that 8 minutes after it woke up. That's the distance it takes for... Wait, 30 minutes. 30 minutes it takes for light to get from Mars to Earth. That's how long it would take for the radio signal to travel. So anyway, we haven't heard from it yet. There's several other opportunities for it to send signals. So if it does have its panels deployed and it does charge up, it will be able to send signals.
Okay, but the potential for this thing is to find life on Mars.
It's got the best shot of any probe that we've sent.
Okay, that's pretty exciting.
Well, my stepdad, he was on the show a little bit.
A couple months ago.
He's working on a project called Mars Observer, Mars Reconnaissance Observer, and they're going to go map Mars. He said that so far the success rate on sending probes to Mars has been about 30%, which if you're in baseball, batting the .300 average, that's great. unfortunately, each ball costs, you know, $10 to $100 million.
Right, right. Well, thank you, John, for that. Miles?
China, Russia, and the United States are going to build a 100 megabyte per second network between the three of them. It's called GLORIAD, the Global Ring Network for Advanced Applications Development, a scientific data network that will connect up academic institutions, universities, and the like between the three countries. And so far, the National Center for Supercomputing Applications has received a $2.8 million grant from the National Science Foundation, and both Russia and China will match this amount to contribute to the network buildup.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It should be exciting to get other internet backbones produced, and that's basically what we're talking about. Well,
this is making a very fast link between them.
Okay.
So
it's neat to see the world shrinking in that way, you know, better communications.
Sure. John?
IBM has announced that they're releasing a new processor in their 970 line for just in time for the latest revision of the G5s from Apple. The 970 chip is the G5 chip, the fifth generation of PowerPC chip that Apple uses in their current computer, their desktop line. The innovative thing about this chip is that they're using a 90 nanometer pathways instead of 130 nanometer. So the transistor sizes and everything have shrunk significantly.
Mm-hmm.
That's important because it allows it to use a lot less energy and it creates a lot less heat while still performing at the same speed, which means they can increase the speed at which it runs and it'll still hold its efficiency.
Great. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Miles?
The Federal District Court in New York has ruled against photographers in a copyright suit. Some photographers for National Geographic were suing because the magazine had released a CD of the archives of the magazine but weren't paying the photographers for copyright on the photos being distributed. And the photographers were alleging that it's a different medium, it's a republishing, they should be getting royalties from it. However, the federal court, district court in New York, has disagreed and said, no, you can do that. So this is going to be a highly contested case.
Do you know if the court really looked at the technology being used to redistribute the CD?
I think they did, although it may be a prejudice against it. In other words, they were thinking, well, it's just the magazine again. It's not really a change in the venue. It's just the magazine again in CD format.
I'm assuming if National Geographic made a calendar and printed a calendar with those same photos, they'd have to buy the rights again. They'd have to pay the
right holders. Because I would assume that the distinction being made was that with a calendar, it's a completely different format. The content is basically different. It's a different project.
So
whereas the CD is just rehashing of the same thing.
But the question really comes in my mind is where the technology lies on the CD. Like, let's say it's HTML documents on the CD somehow, and that's how you look at the web pages. That's how you look at the magazine articles, actually, all these HTML documents, which means that the images are actually probably in an image directory, and you could potentially go in the image directory and see all the images out of context of the magazine.
To be honest, I think that it wouldn't be in that open a format.
Right,
I would think it would be something very proprietary.
So the question is, if it was a proprietary format and those images are protected where a user couldn't see those images without seeing the magazine as it was supposed to be displayed when it was printed, then I would agree with the court. But if there was a potential for a user to see those images outside of the context of the magazine, then it's a different type of format.
But why does that matter? The copying ability, when you have a magazine, you can still scan that in with a scanner.
Yeah, but this is more about a publisher presents work a certain way in a certain layout form.
Mm-hmm.
And if that layout form is consistent, even if it's in different media, if it's in a book form versus a magazine form, or if it's slightly different magazine form, like different types of paper, that's the same real thing. But if you then all of a sudden produce something that is a listing of all these images, similar to a calendar, those are different things. Those have different...
Well, let's say, for example, you have a magazine and, like, say you had National Geographic, and mm-hmm. then... an issue from the 80s was extremely pertinent to today and extremely popular, and so they redistributed it. Wouldn't you get royalties from the second redistribution?
I would think so, yeah. Interesting. So that could probably potentially be part of this case. I'm sure.
So like I said, this is a highly contentious case.
Definitely.
I'm sure it's going to be go to appeal.
All right, John?
I think this is the first we're going to see in a lot of these cases, just because we're grappling with, you know, the web technology, internet technology, and computer technology in ways we've never had to before.
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of grappling with technology, Apple has released the latest patches for OS 10 for Panther. They fixed a bunch of holes. There was one in the kernel where if a system was running with core files enabled, a user could inadvertently gain shell access.
So there was some overwrite security potential.
Yeah, overwrite some files that they really shouldn't overwrite. It looks like it fixed a bunch of stuff in inetd. Actually, I don't know if it runs inetd, but it fixed a bunch of like open SSH.
And just to
I can see the audience is like.
In any case,
inetd controls all the how your computer talks to the outside world via internet, via not peripherals, but.
They released this patch, I think, they released last week because it was available on the 23rd when I was at work. And I did, when I went ahead and updated my G4 laptop, and everything went swell. So I would recommend that it's a good one. I don't know of any complaints so far. Maybe we can kind of research during the show to see if there's been any complaints. I did it, and it was fine.
And like the security holes are serious enough that people should be patching their systems.
Yes. It's 10.3.2, John?
I don't know if it gave it an actual point.
I think it does. But we'll find that out as we go. But that's about it for the news. Or do you have something else, Miles?
Just one last thing. Something that's going on to a ballot, or it's a proposed ballot measure that law enforcement officials are backing for the collection of DNA for criminals. Basically, it's an extension of getting the fingerprints, and when someone gets arrested, when you're booked, you take someone's fingerprints, and later on they can match that up against a crime scene. The same thing being done with DNA. However, this one is being this one is being expanded so that it's not just like a convicted felon, for example. Although that has its own implications, this one is being extended to include nonviolent offenders, juveniles, and uncharged suspects. In other words, someone who's simply been arrested. Someone who's been arrested and booked.
When you get arrested and booked, I'm assuming that's when fingerprints happen too. So it's a mirror of the fingerprints, right?
Yeah. Okay. And at the same time, you haven't actually been found guilty of the crime. But
we're going to get a sample of your tissue anyway. Well, the precedence of a fingerprint is, that's a pretty strong precedence. DNA sample is very similar to a fingerprint in a lot of ways. It's unique identification of a person that comes from their bio.
Actually, DNA isn't necessarily unique. I mean, it is unique. It isn't necessarily unique for a person. What it is a lot of times with DNA testing is you're going to be able to rule out that it's someone else.
But
not necessarily
just,
that it's a particular
person. That's just the
level.
First off, that's just the level of the of the detection that they're using. DNA is unique to a person, except for in the case of identical twins or clones. But the tests that are normally done on DNA is chromosome weight is basically what it is. You take the chromosome strands and you put them in a medium and you run electricity through that medium.
Right.
And the strands will slowly migrate off to one side, and the denser ones will get there slower because it has to move through material. And so you'll get these patterns of chromosome collections, and those represent a person. But those aren't an exact fingerprint for a person. It's kind of a loose fingerprint, and it allows you to rule them out. So that's how normal tests are done, but even though the genetic material is a certain way. I would find that this would be a much better case to make a sample of a person, do that test, make that strip that represents kind of their fingerprint, and then save that and only that. Because the idea of saving someone's DNA is a little freaky with cloning existing.
Isn't that whole process really expensive, though?
I guess I'm not too worried about cloning, because who would really want to clone a murderer, for example?
Okay, it's not just cloning, though. It's also the potential of knowing a lot more about the person than you necessarily want someone to know. Like, if I get booked for some crime, and especially if I don't get charged, if I just get booked for it, right, and they take my fingerprints, they know what my fingerprints are. That's pretty much all they know about me. And then they know that I have 10 fingers. That's pretty much it, right? But if they take my DNA sample, they can find out what types of, what kind of diseases I might be prone to, what kind of diseases I may have, my hair color. They have a whole bunch of information about me that it's not something that they asked for. And I don't know. It seems like a security issue. I'm sure we'll see a lot more of that, or a privacy issue, rather.
And talks about the program will be funded through a $10 surcharge on misdemeanor bail forfeitures and would generate an estimated $25 million a year.
Now, are they doing this right now in a test program?
No, this is a proposed ballot measure. This is something something that Californians have to vote on.
Huh. Tough one. We might have to do a whole show on that. Geeks, John and Miles, thank you for covering the news this morning.
You're welcome.
We are talking today about home life with children and the possible involvement of technology. John Tracy has two wonderful children, 3 and 6, and works from home. Miles has no children and probably won't speak much, but we welcome him to join our conversation. My brother-in-law, Bruce Elliott, has a BA in music from Hart School of Connecticut and a master's in education from Antioch New England Graduate School in New Hampshire. Bruce taught for 5 years at Keene, New Hampshire's Waldorf School and has 3 children, 2, 4, and 6. Bruce, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you. Thank you for welcoming me to your show while I'm in town.
Sure. It's kind of a kick. We're right now, my home is filled with my sister and Bruce's family of 3, and it's been a kick to have all the kids running around and playing, and there'll be more of that as we run into John later today and John's family. But what we decided to do today on a Geek Speak show, with some of the geeks gone and it being the holiday season, is to talk a little bit about home life with children and the differences that parents get involved with. And since it's Geek Speak, we're going to talk about technology differences or the lack of technology and kind of discuss why we're at the stages we're at. So, John, let's talk quickly about Quinn. He's 6 years old. Both Bruce and John have six-year-olds. Quinn is relatively tech-savvy, correct? He uses technology.
Yeah.
Can you describe a little bit about the kind of technology he uses currently and is involved in his life?
We have a small LAN at our house, a small group of computers all talking together. So we do we play different LAN games.
So computer games.
Yeah, racing games, things like that. And he's got a couple of different toys, like a Leap Pad learning pad, which is it's like an interactive desk. It's got a book on it and a pen. You touch the pen to different parts of the book, and it, you know, has different games you can play, or different, you know, teaches you to read, teaches you to do math, things like that.
So it's kind of it's a learning toy.
Right.
Or it's a, okay.
And he's very, you know, ever since he was little, we've played with computers. When he was really little, I had a microphone hooked up to a computer, and we would record him saying stuff into it. And so he learned about technology from a very young age.
Okay. And I would say that you're a relatively technical, savvy person. You're on a geek show every week. So you're pretty on, I mean, you're pretty involved in technology yourself.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about that kind of extreme opposite with Morgan and Bruce's. And so, Bruce, let's talk, tell me quickly what Morgan's life with regards to technology is like.
Yeah, so Morgan is our 6-year-old, the oldest child. And so his life with technology is actually not a life without, it is a life without technology. So it is the other extreme, really. So in our home, since Morgan was born, we have not had a television even. So it's a really, in that sense, an alternative kind of lifestyle to really step outside of the whole experience of daily interfacing with technology. And the choice was made to have a home life where it's really just interacting with the people in the space that are right there.
Do you have radio? Do you listen to the radio?
We've actually listened to the radio very little while Morgan was awake in these first part of his life. That's something that is changing a little bit now as, well, actually, specifically radio, actually, we almost never listen to the radio with them, but we do listen to recorded music. Though even early on, we listened to very little recorded music while he was awake. So he had, in a sense, an almost technology-free first 6 years of his life.
Okay. Now, and of course, you listen to some music because both you and Adriana like music. So you still had music in your life. You just tried to do it when he was asleep or when one of you was away. That kind of thing?
Well, I am a musician, and actually what I decided to do when he was born was really shift my whole focus from the music I had been doing before, when our home became not just a couple, two people living together, but a place where there was a young child. It changed the whole mood of our house, and I began really playing, just doing a lot of music there with him. More, instead of playing saxophone so much, I switched to playing acoustic guitar and singing folk songs and lullabies and doing music that was music that seemed to fit the mood of having a little baby around.
Right. Well, that makes sense. I mean, everyone makes the adjustments, at least putting the safety locks on, and it's a whole environment change for a kid environment. You have a phone, so that's a technology thing, right?
Right. We have a telephone.
That's something I'd like to interject. Should we define technology?
Well, technology is
I mean, as we're
talking
about it.
Yeah, we should.
A pencil is a technology,
electronic
too,
technology,
right?
Is what we're talking about.
We're talking about
I think most of what we're talking about is interactive media, things that you listen to, things that you watch, things that you, electronic gizmos you play with, things like that.
That's right.
Okay.
Information
coming
from technology. Yeah, information coming from technology is what we're talking about, right?
Right. Like a microwave is not
Well, do you have a microwave?
Interactive technology.
We don't have a microwave.
Okay.
I mean, so yeah, I mean, it does permeate into other aspects of our life. It just generally tends to be a sort of old-fashioned kind of lifestyle in our house. But not having a microwave probably doesn't have too much impact on his experience and what we're talking about here.
Now, the phone, though, I'm curious about this because a lot of what we're talking about is getting this idea. We communicate even if it's one way through television. You know, we get a lot of information through television. The society as a whole, and your home doesn't have that. My home doesn't actually have television from the broadcast perspective anyway, as well. But in any case, the telephone is like that as well. There's information coming from this hard non-human thing, even though it's a human on the other side. Did you have the phone be part of his life early on? Like in the 2-year-old range?
Not much. Okay. No, I mean, just occasionally, say, talking to a grandparent at home, but not really, not like having him call people or having him talk to people on the phone casually on a daily basis. Yeah.
All right. Now, before you had children, Bruce, did you have a television in your home?
Yeah, I did. Although Adriana and I never had a television once we moved in together. Mm-hmm. But as a child, I watched extensive amounts of television, and that definitely played into my choices as a parent. You know, I considered myself to have wasted a great deal of time and basically been a television addict.
I feel your pain, Bruce. I've been there.
Yeah, you too, John.
So I'd had enough.
We when Quinn was first born, we made the conscious choice not to have a television also. But after a while of that, a couple of years, I think, we decided, you know, let's get a television and a VCR. Because there are some pretty cool videos out there for kids. Okay. So we decided to do that. And then when the TiVo came out, I researched it heavily and saw that, okay, this is a way that we could allow TV into the house without getting everything. TiVo has definitely given us a way to select exactly what the kids watch and what we watch, a way to not expose them to commercials, a way to filter everything that comes into our house. And yet still maintain, you know, like there's a lot of great shows that the National Science Foundation puts out that are great for kids, I think, because there's a lot of concepts that come across.
Well, let's talk about what you think of the technology, John, that you are that your kids are involved with, what you think is a benefit and what you personally think is maybe not.
Well, like I said, there's some great shows out there, you know, like Bill Nye the Science Guy. We used to watch that all the time when it was on. There's a new one called Cyber Chase, which is, you know, basically they're teaching kids the beginnings of science and understanding and comparative thought and rational thought. So I think that's a great tool, being able to do that. And Quinn and I watch a lot of space programs together, learning about different aspects of space. Things, information I don't feel that we could find just by going and reading magazines or going to the library, because it's all current information coming in.
Okay. And what about that game, for example, you have? You have a few music games that are like block toys that you move around that actually produce music as you move them around.
Right.
What do you think about those?
They're fun. I don't know that from a learning standpoint the kids get a lot out of them, but they're a lot of fun. And, you know, it helps them interact with music and show that they can do music. I almost think something we have that's more useful is a box full of instruments that we bring out and play with that.
So you don't ban musical instruments from your home? No,
we did not go the opposite direction where we can't have any non-technology things. No, in fact, the other day on the solstice, my son had some friends sleeping over, and they started banging on boxes and stuff like that and making music. And so I brought down, we got out the computer, which has a microphone built into it, and started recording some of their stuff. And then they realized, wow, we can make music. We can make sounds and reproduce that and make music out of it. And so they wanted to form a band. So we made about, I don't know, a dozen songs over the weekend.
Fun.
Yeah. You know, and I got all our instruments out, our drums and our didgeridoos.
And are you releasing that sometime on Capitol Records or something?
Probably not. I don't know. We got a deal in the works now. We'll let you know.
All right. Well, that brings up an interesting thing. There's this whole excitement. I mean, I get excited about technology. And I know, John, you do, and Miles, you do. We're geeks. We do that. We get excited about technology.
I hate computers.
But you still get excited about it.
And how does that play, Bruce, in your life? Do you get excited about technology, new nifty gizmos, or kind of non-interest you?
Yeah, I do get excited about nifty gizmos and new technology that comes out. And I think that that actually plays into my choices in giving my children an experience of living in daily life without that, because I think that's part of the commercialism that is inherent in a lot of the technology that exists, and not all, of course, but a lot of it is about selling a product, and it's so appealing that a child doesn't really have the world savvy, the sense of who they are enough to make choices about what things would be good for them to get involved with and what things they wouldn't. And that is maybe not such a primary piece, but it's a little bit of a piece of where I come from on as a parent. Those excitements, it's all very alluring, and a child, I think, would be even more allured by that.
Right.
A recent comment that my son made was, it says, of course we see TV every now and then at the airport, for example, flying out here on the plane, there's TVs. So what he just said to me yesterday, after having flown out here and seen all the TV and video things on the airplane, is, why do you let me watch, if we don't watch TV, why do you let me watch TV on the airplane? Because then I just want more. And so, he puts that as a question. He's somewhat aware that he wants more because he's seen that. And of course, I understand that appeal to that draw is very tantalizing, and you just want more and more. And so I'm glad that he doesn't have more.
We'll get into more of the reasons why you guys made these choices in just a moment. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. If you have questions or comments about our topic, the numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, 1-800-655-5877. Or you can use the Internet if you wish. Visit geekspeak.org, click on The Geeks, and then click on Send a Message. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geekspeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are John Tracy, Bruce Elliott, and Miles Elam. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing Internet services, including DSL and spam filters, for home and office throughout Santa Cruz County. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. If you have questions and comments, we really urge you to participate in today's show. It'd be a blast to call in. Bruce has taught at Waldorf School. If you're curious about Waldorf School, he has a bit of information about that. And in general, about geek information regarding to children. That's what we're talking about today. The phone number is, again, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org and find a way to send us a message from there. All right. Bruce, John, we'll start with Bruce. Why do you make the decision to kind of limit the technology for your children? I mean, you just touched a large part on part of that, but elaborate more. Why you made the decision, and was it conscious?
Yeah, there was a lot of consideration ahead of time about this kind of thing, and what kind of atmosphere we would want in our house, and what kind of experiences we would want our children to have. So it's definitely a conscious decision, as to the extent that we were able to make it that. And a major piece of it is a developmental picture that I have of child development, and since we've only been talking about early childhood, we have a picture of we've described our house as being a house that doesn't have technology, basically, and that is because we're only talking about the early time of life. And the picture I have of child development is that is the time where I would least want technology to be part of my children's experience. But as they grow older, I think that will have a more relevant role. And so that's a pretty significant piece of the picture, is that I'm not saying that technology should not be part of people's lives, but that I want to give my children an experience of having a technology-free early childhood, and that when they're more developed in their own process as adolescents and then as adults, I would expect them to then make choices about where to use that. And I would imagine being also involved with that during that transition time of that whole space,
okay,
from
so
12 to 18.
Or in this early stages that kids are currently in, what, not necessarily that technology would be hampering on some things, but can you explain some stuff that you think can be learned really well with technology being away from them? What are some things that they're learning right now that really produces a need for the lack of technology?
Yeah, that's a great question, because part of what our country as a whole approaches learning very much with an emphasis on intellectual learning. And what they can really learn by living without the technology are the aspects maybe that don't have so much to do with intellectual learning, but other aspects of learning. So experiential learning, spending the time doing things, making things with their hands, or playing outside, experiencing the natural world in this kind of intimate way that a young child is just bathed in their surroundings, and being outside and this connection with nature that can develop, that actually can provide the kind of passion and love for exploring the sciences later on in life at high school age or college and beyond. That's a very significant kind of learning. So
you mean this idea that playing in a garden or playing just in some dirt for hours on end, which might not actually happen if there was more, quote, exciting things to happen, like television, which we probably all experienced as young kids. But in the dirt, just spending there for 3 hours looking at the little rocks in the dirt is something that isn't necessarily this pinnacle of excitement for adults or even for a lot of kids, but they'll do that, and they get some kind of inherent benefit from that?
Yeah, I think they definitely do. I think that young children in particular experience the whole much more than they experience individual parts and the kind of dissection of things that we all as adults perceive about the world. A child, particularly when they're younger, I believe they experience the whole of everything much more. They don't see all the isolations and the breakdown of the different individual parts. And so to just experience the sand, to feel the texture on your skin, is a learning for them. To get to just have the sense of what the sand is like. It's, in a sense, a spiritual communion with the earth element, if you will, even, to go that far.
Listeners, How much technology do you think is healthy for your kids to be exposed to? The phone numbers are 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. Do you have experiences from your own childhood, such as limited TV, something of that nature, you can share with us that you think is beneficial or some kind of interesting story about technology in your own childhood development? And how do you handle your own kids' technology today? The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We'd love to hear from you. You can, of course, go to geekspeak.org, click on The Geeks, and then send a message. So, John, I'm assuming, you have a garden. Your kids play in the dirt.
Yes.
Do you balance that somehow? Do you try to limit the amount of technology that is in their lives?
Yeah, it's a constant battle. I don't know if battle's the right word, but it's something we constantly strive to do, is to have our children spend more time.
When
it gets to be a problem, Quinn loves computer games. I mean, I love computer games too. You know, they're highly entertaining. They're involved. They excite your brain. They have pretty images. I mean, there's a huge draw to go in there. But they don't really produce anything. They don't really give you anything back. They just take away time. They don't really give you any. I don't know. All you have is the experience with them. They don't really give anything other than that.
Mm-hmm.
And the experience isn't always positive.
And it's kind of limiting the amount of experience it gives you. I mean, it basically, there's some touch on your fingertips, and you can hear stuff and you can see stuff. That's it. You're not going to feel it.
Well, it does. I mean, there's a lot of them that, they involve strategy.
Yeah. So there's a lot of brain power.
Right, there's a lot of, sure. There's a lot of puzzle solving. There's a lot of things like that. But we do often find ourselves going, wow, he has been doing a lot of computer time. And we start... One of the things we tried was we made a list of things he could do that would gain him so many minutes on the computer time. Like when he's learning to tie his shoes, you get this many minutes for tying your shoes, you get this many minutes for fixing yourself cereal in the morning, you get this many minutes for doing this. So we had this list of things that he knew he could do to earn computer time. And then he would do those things, and then he would get computer time. Then he'd go use up his computer time, and when he's done, he'd, find something else to do.
Right. What computer games does he like to play?
It varies. We have some learning games, there's LucasArts makes a bunch of games based on the Star Wars universe,
mm-hmm.
which he's very much into Star Wars. So,
I remember one of those. There was there were droids walking across the screen, and there was certain points you were supposed to do some kind of musical.
Right, they're
thing.
Different logic games.
Yeah,
where you're trying
and it involves music sometimes.
Right, yeah. There's one that teaches you how to read music, and mm-hmm. Quinn got that. He got that. Okay, if the note is here on the bar scale, that means it's this tone, this sound. So there are different things like that. And
But you're working on this because it's such an, especially like a computer game, it's such an enveloping thing for a child that you really work at trying to get time away from that.
Right, and we're very fortunate in that when we tell Quinn, hey, you know what, we feel you've been spending too much time on the computer, we need to do other things, he will make a conscious effort and a conscious decision to not do computer stuff then, but to go and find other things to do. So we're very lucky in that he, you know, has that self-discipline within himself to do that.
And it's possible because he's old enough. I mean, there's a lot of extensive, I mean, maybe a younger child wouldn't have that self-discipline. Like my two-year-old, if he wants to do something, he wants to do it now, and there's not a lot of talking about, you know, well, maybe we should do something else for a while. It's almost like you've got to trick them out of that.
I must say, your son is also very technical savvy. I mean, whenever he sees something with a button on it, he will go over, push the button, turn it on, and start playing with it, no matter what it is.
Yeah.
So he's, you know.
And there's been a big learning experience, actually. Wyatt, I'll talk briefly about my son, Wyatt. He's two. And right now, because we have the Elliots in our home, we don't have any television on. The television's put away. And Wyatt traditionally will watch at least a show a day. And he's not doing that right now. And he's been asking for it, but there's been so much other things going on that he hasn't been missing it at all. And it's because of such an active family that Bruce has brought into our home that it's quite a neat experience. I'm really enjoying it.
I must say that to involve children, once you've used technology, you know, TV or computer or whatever, you get used to that, you know, involving your children that way. And, you know, there's, you know, obviously you sit and you watch the programs with them and you talk to them about it. And, you know, you sit and play video games with them and you talk to them about it. But then without that, it takes a tremendous effort on the part of the parent in order to have, you know, an interaction where you're both getting something out of it. That's, I don't know. I don't know why, but it seems like there's so much more effort involved in getting them, you know, into something else that's not self-entertaining, but to, you know, help bring that fun into it and help bring that desire to do something else.
Right.
I don't know if that's from me because I'm a geek and I love to play with technology.
So you're kind of lacking. You kind of want the stuff that you're not able to do.
Exactly.
With your kids.
Yeah, I think a lot of the exposure Quinn's gotten has been through me wanting to do it.
Well, you know, that's a big part of it. Kids are becoming part of your life, and whoever you are is going to be involved with them. I mean, Bruce, you have a lot of music in your life because you're a musician. I mean, that something happens. And John, you're a technology geek person, and you've got a lot of technology in your life, and I have a lot of technology in my life. So there's that whole concept that, yeah, we raise our kids with us. It's not like we can totally isolate them from who we are and try to make a perfect world. And, Bruce, it's really interesting to hear that you changed a lot of what you had around your home, specifically because you had kids. But, and to some extent, you still have a computer in your home, and it sits underneath a sheet, and it's in a room that is only used, I'm assuming, when the kids are asleep or something of that nature.
Mostly, it's changed a little bit recently as we, you know, evolve as parents who constantly reassessing, is this really the right approach? And we don't want to create a sense of any kind of fear about the technology, too. And we've had to work with that because we don't, you know, by isolating them away from it, they're aware that it's out there. And so it takes a lot of effort, in other words, to create that extreme an alternative in your mm-hmm. lifestyle, because you're really carving yourself out of society a little in this particular way.
Right.
So we have... Now, we try to develop a relationship to it. We use it as a tool, and so we let them see what we're doing, and we haven't given them games to play on it because we've decided that we don't want them to spend their time doing that, but we do more openly use the computer in front of them in order to just be real about who we are in our work lives and that we use this tool, and so, of course, you can see us using it. That's not
right.
Anything to be afraid of.
Right. So, I mean, just like if you were taking trees down, you'd let them see you move a chainsaw, but you wouldn't be. I mean, of course, it's not the same thing, but right. You'd have to, you know, safety reasons. We have someone on the phone. We're going to take them just a second. I want to quickly mention my childhood. I didn't have a television until I was 12, and I specifically asked for my 12th birthday to have a TV because we didn't have a TV in the home, and I really wanted. My parents were both artists, and we did a lot of art. But I remember around the age of 12, maybe a little bit before that, we had someone else in the neighborhood that had a television, and I would do anything to go over there. And if I ever went there and the TV was on, didn't matter what there was, I did that zombie effect that kids do sometimes with a TV. I was very into it, so much so that I would let hours pass without knowing about it. And that really does happen when you're not around a television, I think. And I remember at the age of 15 and stuff thinking, well, if you have a television in the home, then you won't have that zombie effect when you see a TV because you'll be used to it. I don't know if that's true or not, because you probably spend a lot of time with the TV and you get used to it in that sense. But it was very interesting from my childhood to see that.
I've noticed one of the things when we take Quinn over to, you know, like our cousin's house or wherever, where there is a television going on, where there are commercials playing, if it's not a program he wants to watch, he won't sit there in front of the TV. He will, you know, he'll turn to me and say, can we go do something else? Or, you know, the other kids will be drawn in by the sound and the noise. And I've noticed that since we're really selective about what we watch, well, I like to think that's why, if it's not something he's interested in, he will go do something else.
We have Josh from Salinas. Josh, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
So what do your kids do with tech?
Well, they both love TV, and they both love using the computer, especially for internet. I got a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
It has been necessary at points to sharply curtail both. We do have a rule in the house. We have an electronic kitchen timer on top of the TV. If the kids are watching TV, it has to be on. They get an hour a day. When it beeps, they have to turn off the TV.
And that kind of reinforces that whole concept. They really want to choose something that they want to watch.
Yeah, they do. I'm still trying to figure out how I can get them to watch something informational. I keep on suggesting, why don't you watch Discovery Channel? Do this, do that. No, they want to watch entertainment, and they do, and they use up their hour.
Watching cartoons. Yeah.
And then we have AOL, so it is possible to limit their amount of time on the internet, which before was just the cut and dry thing. Okay, you get this much time, and that's that. But now they both need to do research on the internet, so it kind of blurs the line between entertainment and schoolwork on the computer. I wish that AOL had half-hour increments, but their minimum increment is an hour. I don't really think they need an hour a day on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Teens seem to think they need several hours a day on the internet.
Interesting. Are they interacting with people they know through the internet?
Yeah. And that's, I suppose, a good thing. I don't want them interacting with strangers on the internet.
So, you think you're doing a good job with the technology in your home? Do you feel like you're lacking in something? Do you feel like technology can help? I mean, you're suggesting that AOL offering a different amount of time increments would actually be able to help you a little bit. So that's a technology solution, right?
Yeah, I heard you talking about computer games, too, and I think we're doing a pretty decent job with that. My kids went through all kinds of good stuff on computer games, doing beanies, and you were talking about LucasArts. LucasArts has a great ecology managing game. And my daughter became an expert ecology manager.
Yeah, the Gungan Frontier, that is a good one.
And is she the 15-year-old?
She's 12,
okay. Well, that is, of course, is an older age of kids than we're talking about. And, Bruce, earlier you mentioned that at some point, I think you even used the 12 as kind of an age range where you start seeing the technology become more of a use. Josh, did you have this kind of activity, this kind of interaction with the television and the computer at the age of 4 and 5?
Black and white Mac classic. they liked the playroom. We controlled TV much more strictly at that time. It was something that we turn on and off, and
right.
We would get only public television, period.
Right.
At that age.
Well, Josh, thank you very much for calling in to Geek Speak.
Thank you.
Again, I feel that's one of the ways TiVo has really made TV ours. It's our tool that we could do what we want with.
And it's interesting that the technology improvement that allows you to use the technology more effectively kind of thing.
Absolutely. Well, it allows you to use it as a tool instead of this, you know, dangerous box sitting in the corner.
Marilyn from Aptos, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you. My name's Marilyn. I'm a retired school teacher.
What ages?
I taught first, second, and third grade.
Okay.
And I would always encourage the kids to go out and observe nature and bring in plants and insects, and I'd bring Daddy Long Legs for them to observe and write about, et cetera. And I think it's very crucial that children are able to have hands-on and be connected with the natural world. Sitting in front of computers, and I myself, I have to tell you, I'm electrosensitive, so I don't sit in front of a computer. I get my eyes are irritated. I know how to type on a manual typewriter. And what we're living in now, I mean, going by cell towers, the infrastructure for the cell phones, I get a headache, pain in the jaws, pressure in the eyes. And in Sweden, for instance, 2% of the population is classified as electrosensitive. So we're living in electrosmog that we didn't evolve with as a species. So this is a major problem to sit children in front of computers where instead of looking out at the landscape, they're focusing their eyes, and there are more children now on this narrow screen, so that there are a lot of eye problems, children with glasses, children getting carpal tunnel problems. My daughter has it at age 35. She works with computers, and I think, you know, that's a loss. But there are a lot of downsides to technology, mm-hmm. including the toxics that are produced, contaminating the whole environment, and what's off-gassing. I want to give a reference here from these computers. I've got in front of me Rachel's Environment and Health News titled, Here We Go Again, PBDEs. It's issue number 736. You can get it at rachels.org. And they say, just one sentence, although all bromated fire retardants seem capable of creating environment and health problems, here we will focus on PBDEs, which leach into the environment from the...
Marilyn, I appreciate your motivation on talking about this, but I'd rather you didn't read from the magazine.
I'm just saying...
The URL again for people to learn more information about what you're speaking about?
Yeah, so it says it's leaching from the computers. So as you sit kids in front of computers, this is leaching into the environment that they are breathing and enmeshed in all day. It's a major problem. So I was trying to think of somebody else who wrote on this as a reference, but if you look at rachels.org, issue number 736 about PBDEs, you'll
Thank
see
you.
About the toxic. So,
thank you, Marilyn.
Yeah, bye.
Bruce?
Well, Marilyn raises some interesting things that perhaps I could just give my spin on some of that, which is that I think we could say that those things are perhaps sounding a bit extreme to most people who use these machines on a daily basis that don't experience the kind of physical effects that she says she does experience. And so it's hard to be compassionate of that maybe if you don't experience those physical effects. But I think it's important to hear what she's saying because she's perhaps maybe an important person
in learning more about
on a societal level that these few people who are so sensitive to this, perhaps we need to listen to what they're experiencing in order to help us understand what we've got. Because what I'm really hearing from the first caller and from John are these parents who are really involved in what the technology is to try to make the best decisions they can in informing it for their children as opposed to letting it just be wide open. But on a more societal level, I wonder how much, especially people who are really busy with their jobs and trying to just make a living to support their family, how thoroughly they can really understand all the different shows and computer programs and internet access that their children have to be quite as conscientious about it as John and the other caller that called in can be. So if that connection is quite clear yet that to someone like Marilyn, then we need to take some note of that. See where are we going as a society
The environmental features that Marilyn's talking about, and that's a really important thing to think about your kids, not just from the information side of it, but the environmental side. It is true that computers are made of pretty toxic things. We're dealing with a serious problem right now with the end use of a computer, the trashing of a computer, and what happens. There's horrible stories about whole towns getting destroyed in China from recycling systems that are not really set up. And then there's this whole thing that I always bounce off. For a long time, we used lead paint in the homes, and lead paint is a definite danger for kids, and we thought it was okay. So this idea that we know everything about computers is not necessarily true. I'm a little more optimistic, I think, than Marilyn is about what computers are. I think we have a lot of testing now about what kind of environment effects a computer in the home has, what kind of outgassing occurs. It is true that stuff does outgas. The basic concept of it is that there's partial molecular breakdown of everything, and that can actually get into the environment. So the question is whether that's a danger or not, and I'm not an expert on that, but it is a giant field. But you're right. Thinking about that kind of stuff as a parent, it becomes a pretty big job. John?
I think she also had a good point about the ergonomic issues. I've noticed, you know, posture not problems, but Quinn used to have excellent posture. I know he slouches a little more now, and I have to keep on him about sitting up straight.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, what she's talking about, eye strain, things like that. A lot of times kids interact with computers at schools, and the schools don't have the money to afford the best equipment, so the monitors may be a little substandard. And it can lead to a lot of problems, and I think that's a, you know, that's a valid issue to look at.
Miles?
Something I believe I had heard on NPR, actually, a couple of weeks ago, was with regards to eye strain, which is a definite issue among young children, but it also may have to do with just focusing on a single thing. Like, they're seeing the same thing in children who are reading at an early age, that they're focusing so close to them for so long a period of time that it's screwing up their long field of vision.
Right. I mean, it comes down to how the eyes work. There are two different muscles that pull the eye, well, lots of muscles, but two muscles that pull them out and in. And when you focus closer, you pull the eyes in. And those muscles have to be in strain when you focus at a specific point. And the idea, if you were to try to hold a leg at a certain point for a long time, it's going to hurt. That's what happens with the eyes. So you really do want, especially for children, you really want to make sure that they have this long range and short range focusing point. Earlier, Josh called in and suggested that time limits, that's one of the things, and John, you mentioned this too, you have time limits in a different way. You kind of proactively set time. You let them kind of decide how much time they want by building up time with other things. And Josh uses just a timer, a straight timer, you only get this amount of time. Do you think this time limit on technology, Bruce, is a good way of solving the problem for, or do you like the idea?
Well, it's sort of what I was saying before about becoming a conscientious user of the technology, which is definitely a different way of living than what I've chosen. So I still feel that I'm doing the right thing in terms of having no technology, interactive technology in my home for the ages of children that I have. But I think that there's some value in that as a parent of being conscientious about what how your children are using it.
So it's
good.
How do you think it's going to affect your younger children as Morgan gets older? Since Morgan's, 2 years and 4 years older than his younger siblings, how do you think that's going to affect when he's of the age where he starts using the computer?
I think it's very difficult to manage that, those kinds of, to have such an extreme lifestyle that you consider to be developmentally based, then to have different age children in that situation is very difficult. Because if it's going to change for him, then the one who's 4 years younger is going to be very aware of what he gets. So, and already we have that experience of the kind of protection and environment that we had for him when he was the first only child there is just very different for the third child in a lot of ways. So it's going to be an interesting negotiation that we're going to have to figure out when we get there.
Is there anything else you wanted to talk about quickly? I mean, we didn't touch at all on education in a school setting. Your oldest is now doing schooling partially, and Quinn, John, is at home doing education and some outside. But what do you think about in a school environment? Are they old enough? I mean, can you give us some ideas on that?
If you don't mind, I used to be the director of technology at the school district in San Lorenzo Valley, and my take on computers up there was any time after third grade was fine, but I always felt like there should be this division. The primary grade should not have interaction with computers, because I don't feel like that they were ready for the things computers had to offer in a school setting. I thought that there was a lot more that could be taught not using technology. I felt technology was a burden as opposed to a teaching tool. When it gets older,
a crutch to some degree.
Right. As they get older, there's a lot of great information that can be gained from a computer. But up until that time, I feel that, yeah, it's a crutch, and it's taking the place of a lot of other good teaching.
We're going to take a quick call from Ellen of Scotts Valley. Ellen, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yes, thank you. Well, I want to say that I just agree with that last statement. We, our family up here, have a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old. We have no TV in our home, but we do have a computer. I need it. I'm finishing a teaching credential. I can relate to Marilyn. I want to teach grades K through 3. And I also did some case study in my learning on a child who was being very distracted and distracting in the classroom, and he was a complete little geek, second grader, and spent all his time, as much as he could, at home and at school on the computers, and was a whiz. I mean, he says he wants to be design software, and I have no doubt he'll do that when he grows up. But in any case, I did a lot of research, and I agree with Marilyn, and I agree with the last caller. I think that below age 8, there's just no reason whatsoever children should be on computers. I get very upset when I go to my daughter's preschool and find her, because she was too late to be kinder this year. But anyway, I get upset when I go into early preschools and kindergartens and find kids in front of computers.
Right.
It's just totally not healthy for them. They should be, as Marilyn said, doing hands-on activities. They should be away from those computer monitors.
Well, thank you, Ellen, from your free
call. But I just want to give a couple important information, resources. AllianceForChildren.net has an incredible, thorough study called Fool's Gold.
And the next one?
And Todd Oppenheimer, who wrote an op-ed a few years ago about the computer, has now put together a whole book called The Flickering Mind.
From Todd Oppenheimer?
And I would
thank
really
you, Ellen. I've got to go,
okay.
But thank you very much for that information.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. It is true that there's a lot of people in our listening area that don't do television with their kids. We are out of time on GeekSpeak. This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. Our guest today was Bruce Elliott. Bruce, thank you very much for coming on today and talking about your family life.
Thank you, Lyle.
Our geeks today were Miles Elam and John Tracy. And John, again, thank you for welcoming your
Are you saying I'm not a geek?
You're a geek, yes. We'll let you be a geek since you're on GeekSpeak.
Thank you.
Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Answering the phone today was Bonnie Jean Primsch. Thank you all for your participation in GeekSpeak. For those of you that called in, thank you for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without your input, it would just be us geeking out. And who wants to listen to that? This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, or on the web at KUSP.org. For GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Coming up next, and right now on KUSP, is Fine Print.